This is Henry Banks, producer and host of People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. On the show today, I have a conversation with Mr. Henry Boucher, a National Hockey League legend from Warold, Minnesota. Mr. Boucher is a full-blooded Chippewa Ojibwe. He was a center man and played 247 games over six seasons in the NHL. He played for the Detroit Red Wings, the Minnesota North Stars, the Kansas City Scouts, and the Colorado Rockies. His career was cut short by an eye injury. He was inducted into the United States Hockey Hall of Fame in 1995. Today is joined in the WPR studios by his granddaughter and UWS student, Shalise Snowden. Shalise is majoring in legal studies and is seeking a First Nations minor during her enrollment at UWS. Also on the show, a conversation with Mary Villiard, cultural programs coordinator at the American Indian Community Housing Organization in Duluth, Minnesota. Please join me and my guest, Henry Boucher, Shalise Snowden, and Mary Villiard on People of Color after this news. Welcome to People of Color. This is Henry Banks. Thanks for joining us tonight. I am honored to have in the studio Henry Boucher. He is a wonderful National Hockey League legend, and he is here today to have a conversation with us. And he's also joined by his granddaughter. Her name is Shalise Snowden. She's a UWS student majoring in legal studies and a minor in First Nations studies. Welcome to People of Color.
Well, thank you. I sure appreciate it, Henry. It's just a wonderful opportunity to be over here at Superior, visiting with a great crowd today. Very intelligent questions that were asked, and have us a chance to talk about racism in sports and media, as well as some prejudice and the negativity of how it plays a role in our lives and what we can do about it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So you were born on June 1st, 1951 in Warold, Minnesota. You are a retired Native Heritage professional ice hockey player, playing for six seasons in the National Hockey League. You played for such teams as the Detroit Red Wings, the Minnesota North Stars, the Kansas City Scouts, and the Colorado Rockies, just to name a few. You were drafted in 1971. It says here that you were a second-round draft pick by the Detroit Red Wings. You played high school for Warold, and you were one of their top hockey players in the state of Minnesota. And, I am so honored to have you here. It's just hearing your presentation earlier today and then having you in the studio, taking the time to be here with us today. Again, we are honored that you're here. What was it like for you, Mr. Boucher, when you first entered into the professional hockey field?
Well, actually, I came out of Warold High School. I played in Western Canada. Junior hockey was a fast track to the National Hockey League rather than go to college. I had fallen in love and gotten married right out of high school, and I decided to go that way. It was different being an American-born player up in Western Canada, being a native up there. There was some prejudice that we ran into on the ice, in the stands. They were hurtful type comments and, things that you have to deal with as a young man, and certainly was something that I didn't wish anybody had to go through. But, somehow you make it through, you face that adversity, you certainly, it's certainly a character builder for you, at that young age, and a lot of it went in and out my ear, but there are some things that were very negative, and you had to just live through it and find a way to overcome, the ignorance that was out there at the time.
Mm-hmm. And so it sounds as though you've had a positive outlook, even though you experienced racism and prejudice and discriminatory practices. How do you maintain a positive outlook when people are calling you names or treating you differently, how did you handle that?
Well, at times they didn't handle it very well. You know, you'd either break down and cry on the bus after, you know, an altercation, you know, in the arena on the ice, and just couldn't understand the ignorance and where it came from. But it's alive and well. There are other times that you stood up and you fought. You had to fight for your rights and, you know, as for your manhood. And it taught you a lot of lessons. It taught you, you know, how cruel the world can be at times. And while others, you know, comforted you in those times of trouble, that you realize that, you know, you had some true friends out there that couldn't understand the ignorance either.
Mm-hmm. So you have your granddaughter here, and her name is Shalice again, Shalice Snowden. She's an athlete. She's a UWS student. I'm interested in knowing what you shared with her about your experiences related to the discriminatory practices that you experienced as a hockey player, and how she was able to take some of that knowledge and apply it to her athleticism and in everyday life. So I'm going to have you talk about that, and then have Shalice kind of comment on that as well.
Well, I think, you know, our times are different. I think, you know, growing up in the 50s and 60s was quite a bit different. You couldn't say some of those things now without going through some type of sensitivity training. And the kids are so much more intelligent now and are aware of their surroundings so much better than we were, whether it's through technology, whether it's a life and, you know, growth as individuals that are around you. You know, it's you're not going to hear those things nowadays. You may hear some war whoops because of the war at Warriors. You may hear some other derogatory or denigrating remarks by, you know, that ignorant fan or somebody who may be under the influence. But, you know, we pride ourselves into teaching, you know, our kids that, you know, it's basically, it's not you in particular. It's they're hurting. They're the ones that are racist. They're the ones that are, you know, need the education. You just turn the other cheek, you know, at times, and let the superintendents or let the officials take care of, you know, the due process that, you know, that you have coming. Like I said, it's a whole different world, but we had to go through it. And there's no sense in having our grandchildren go through something like that.
Mm-hmm. So for you, Shalice, hearing your grandfather say what he just said, and then you growing up, having this legend as a part of your life. I know he's your grandfather, but he's also a hockey legend. And hearing some of the things that he experienced, can you talk about how those experiences helped you as a person today?
Mm-hmm. I think the things that he's gone through, he's helped educate our family and our community on, I guess, what is right and what's wrong, and that we in Warroad have educated ourselves on, you know, who the Warroad Warriors were and where we come from, and that, you know, if someone does do a war hoop at a game, that we know that that's not real, and we know the history behind it, and we know what that means to us versus them not being uneducated.
Mm-hmm. So you learned a lot from your grandfather,
yes,
it sounds like.
Very much so.
So, Red Berenson, I believe?
Yes.
And Bill Collins.
Right.
When I was looking at your bio and looking at some information about you, these were key people in your life. Can you talk about them briefly and what kind of role they had? I know you played hockey with them, but was there other connections like friendships that established over the years? with these gentlemen?
Well, Red Berenson was a veteran player that came up through the Montreal organization. He was mature. He had a college education at Denver, from Regina, Saskatchewan. He was my center iceman in Detroit and taught me a lot about the defensive side of the game. We worked well together at killing penalties. We worked well together as a checking line with Bill Collins. And, we're all good skaters. We had to, dissect the ice at times through, through the penalty killing and through our defensive play. Red kind of took me under his wing and taught me a lot of that. Billy was more my age, I guess, and not as, elderly as Red had been. And I played with him for 2.5 years over there and learned a lot. Red went on to retire and became coach at Michigan and just retired this year, in fact. And I would see him from time to time. He would call and ask about different players and, what I thought of them and if I saw him play or whatever. But certainly he was that type of guy. And he was a great teacher, great motivator, and sure helped me early on in my career.
Mm-hmm. So you had a signature headband.
I did. And
what's it all about, the signature headband? Why did it become necessary for you to do that?
Well, back in the 70s, we all had long hair, mustaches. I wore contact lenses back then. When I decided to take my helmet off, my hair was all over the place. And, you would sweat would get in your eyes, your hair would get in your eyes. And my reason for wearing it is just to keep the hair out of my eyes and the sweat out of my eyes. But being of Indian heritage, I thought, this could be some type of form of being a rebel or something like that, where, there was a lot of hippies in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I'd get some catcalls after I put the headband on and started wearing it, but I was hesitant for quite a while before I put it on. And it was a game against Pittsburgh that I wore it, and actually I put it on and walked in from our dressing room into where the shower was, and I combed my hair, and the players couldn't see me. And I decided to wear it. It was a white headband,
because
we had white uniforms, and put a little hairspray on. And when I come walking out, there was a big roar.
This is People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. So back in 1973, Mr. Boucher, you tied the National Hockey League mark for the second fastest goal in the NHL, in NHL history. When that happened, how did that make you feel?
I didn't know about it until after the game.
Uh-huh.
I knew it was fast, and it was I was playing a line with Red Berenson and Billy Collins, and against Montreal's top line, and we just they had a breakdown and on their defensive unit, and one of the defensemen actually fell down, and I was able to get in and get my shot off and score that goal. I was wearing the headband at the time, I think wearing that headband, it motivated me more because of the fact that, I felt like I had to play better every game, to keep that motivation in check. And besides, Clyde Belcourt and Dennis Banks and those guys took over Wounded Knee just prior to that or right around that time. And it was, in fact, I got a call from them through the Detroit Red Wing office to, drop what I was doing and get out there and help them. And And you know, I got a lot of razzing, you know, from the players. But once it, you know, once it took effect, I think that people started to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And you know, we even sold headbands at the arena.
Oh, is that right?
And, it was quite an enterprising deal, but it was unique. It you know, it took a lot of nerve to actually put one on and wear it, because I think I was the first. You know, I took the idea from the tennis player.
So would you say you were a trendsetter in hockey?
I guess so.
Great. So you received a nice honor, an incredible honor, by the United States Hockey Hall of Fame back in 1995 when you were selected inducted in the Hockey Hall of Fame. What was that like for you?
Well, it was overwhelming. You know, I always had that humility about my play, and I think it's as much on as you do on the ice as you do off the ice. And I had been working with the Diversity Hockey Task Force for the NHL and USA Hockey, and coaching at Warroad, ran the Indian Ed Department there. I coached. I did real estate, and it was, you know, just all came together after a 10 years of losing my passion, mm-hmm. and finding my way back through my daughter and my family, and doing the right things and caring about what happens, to the community, the Indian Ed Department, the family.
So
it all of that comes together, and you know, having played the state tournament in 1969, and you know, Warroad, you know, had a big impact on the state, and I think that that kind of set it off. And being one of the first NHL players from the United States playing in the National Hockey League, winning a silver medal in Sapporo, Japan, all has something to do with it. And it's, you know, the character of a person that that gets recognized by, you know, their peers. And it was overwhelming. And I, you know, you have to attribute to your mom and dad and family for their support, and community for their support. Mm-hmm. So it was overwhelming. I was glad when it was over, not having to go through that again. It was very...
That had to have been a beautiful occasion.
It was. Herb Brooks was our, you know, keynote speaker. They said it was the biggest one up until that time. And there was a lot of people there from all over the country.
Yeah, rightly so. So if you don't mind taking a moment to talk about here, what ended your hockey career, Boston's Dave Forbes was the person, if you can say it this way, that helped to end your hockey career by what they commonly call the ugly stick swinging incident. What happened in that incident, and do you harbor any ill will toward Mr. Forbes?
Well, you have to forgive him at some point, and to move forward in your own life. And it was a decision that he made. We had come out of the penalty box after 15 minutes. Play had to stop. He had to have it premeditated. Did he intend to injure me, or did he not? It's tough to prove in, you know, any court of law is the intent to injure. He stepped over the line. Should have been out as long as I was out, and got a 10-game suspension from the National Hockey League. He was charged criminally by Gary Flackney from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office for aggravated assault. If you do something like that on the street, you're going to jail. Why would the National Hockey League let that happen? and without any consequences other than a 10-game suspension. What are the kids and the people are going to feel like when they don't have to take that responsibility? And, you know, where is this going? You know, this is crazy. To be able to get away with something like that without the consequences and the responsibility that one should have by, you know, injuring another player in that regard. So I don't feel any ill will at this point. I had to forgive and move forward. And although, you know, it's an everyday thing. I have depth perception problems. I got double vision. You know, my eye has been basically defaced. It's, you know, it bothers me still, but, you know, I don't have that antagonistic type of attitude toward him for any ill will or anything like that. So, you know, you just live with, you play the cards you're dealt and move forward.
Mm-hmm. I am here with Henry Boucher, National Hockey League legend, with his granddaughter, Shalice Snowden. They've joined us today here on People of Color to talk about the history and experience of the National Hockey League, but also to talk about life and things that make us live in this society and become the people we are meant to become. I know that that ordeal that you experienced in the hockey game against Boston and Dave Forbes changed your life forever. And it caused many, many things to happen in your life. And I heard you speak earlier that you experienced some depression episodes and that it just really affected your life for many years, and that you still were able to forgive this person for what he did to you. You know, a lot of people wouldn't do that. But I believe it's because of your integrity and who you are as a person that made it easier for you to do that. And I think it's a part, if I'm saying this correctly, of the Native culture. That's who Native people are. They forgive people. They're very forgiving culture. Is that correct?
That is. It, you know, it comes through spirituality. It comes through you know, our religion, how we perceive the universe and how we perceive each other. And you know, we certainly can't carry this in our gut without it eating us alive and feeling miserable and carrying on day after day with this revenge type attitude. You have to let go of things sometimes that will set you free, you know, and heal you, that that we really should do. A lot of people can't do that. Some people can. Yeah, am I still upset with that a little bit? Yeah, but I forgave him, and you know, and I move forward. There were times when I had deep depression, self-pity problems, blamed the National Hockey League, blamed hockey for it, where I finally forgave them. And now, you know, you move forward. Mm-hmm. You appreciate what hockey did for you now. You know, I wouldn't have been able to travel to Europe three different times without the game of hockey, play as an 18-year-old in world championships right out of high school. Playing the Olympics, you know, where my red, white, and blue represented my family, my community, my, you know, my teammates and people in the United States, and you know, all that's all good. You know, those adversity problems devastate you at times, and you can wander around like a chicken with his head cut off, and you know, you have to try to find a place. You have to find that passion again. You have to have a project to work on. You got to stay close to the family. You you got to be brought back into the realm of the circle, and I think that that happens, but not without a lot of pain and regret, and you know, your passion is gone. It's like walking out a door when things are going so wonderful. It's like walking out a door, going, "What happened? You know, where am I, and what am I going to do now?" You know, so you learn all those, but it takes time.
You did everything you've done and continue to do, despite the odds that were put in your way. You still succeeded. This is People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. You did everything you've done and continue to do, despite the odds that were put in your way. You still succeeded.
Well, thank you. And I hope people buy my book like crazy now.
why don't you talk about your book? But before you do that, I want to ask Shalice. Okay, you're hearing your grandfather. You're sitting next to your grandfather now. What do you think about your grandfather? What makes him special to you?
Well, I mean, aside from being my grandfather and everything that he's done for me, you know, I talked about him being, you know, my motivator, my cultural awareness, my trickster. You know, plays a lot of different roles to me. But, you know, having someone who's such an outstanding athlete, it's really motivational. And it's obviously playing sports here at UWS. I'm not quite in the same league, but, you know, it's still very motivational. And seeing what he does to give back to the Native community, it makes me want to also do that as well.
Mm-hmm. So you've written a book. Why don't you talk about your book and how people might get a copy of that book?
Okay, you can always go to henryboucher.com. You can buy it on Amazon. It's called Henry Boucher Ojibwe, Native American Olympian. And it's part of a series called Native American Olympians that Boucher Films will produce. We plan to start filming in June. We want to do a full movie, but we'll do two cuts on it. The book is very powerful, I think. It only took me 2.5 months to write it while I was up in Alaska. But then it takes you another year or so to select the pictures, move chapters around, try to get it in order. And you can edit and keep editing and editing. And we worked on it for about a year and a half. And then we finally released it in 2013. And I was probably the most nervous time that I've ever had in my life is my book's coming out tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Is anybody going to like it? Is anybody going to buy it? But I started it off with the spirituality of the Ojibwe, or the Anishinaabe, the migration, how we ended up in the Warren area through Grand Portage. How my family came to be and what made me a person that I am today through my mother, through my dad, through the family tragedies, through the family history, and then going on into playing road hockey with a taped up snooze can, and that's how I got my start in hockey, and John Parker buying me a brand new pair of skates when I didn't have any money to buy any used skates even. Those types of things that motivate you, that uplift you, the tragedies, like I said, that are character builders, about my brother passing away and my sister in a house fire. Those types of things that bring a family together, loving and caring, but yet, you know, having to deal with those types of tragedies as a young man. What we did, we didn't have TV, we didn't have four-wheelers, snowmobiles, computers. We had to make our own fun, and that's what we did, basically, is to skate on the river and play road hockey with a taped-up snooze can. And went to some of our games, Laker games, the high school games, and were able to get sticks, broken sticks, and we'd bring them home and repair them and play that way. Some of my older siblings played hockey. But they didn't make it quite as far as I did, but they sure give you a good start. You know, and how we got into, you know, playing hockey in Warroad like that, and the traditions that were there to help you and motivate you through the Warroad Lakers, the high school teams, and, you know, just being out there, making our own fun, basically. So we have that all in the book. It goes from peewees to bantams to high school to junior hockey to the World Championships and Olympics, and finally being able to, sign with my boyhood idols, the Red Wings, and I think it's a really good sports book, but yet it's more in depth. And I want each one of these stories, there's 21 Native American Olympians, and we're going to do a 56-minute venue or part on each one of these. And they're not all going to be the same, because I didn't experience the boarding schools, but I want to talk about the boarding schools. I want to talk about the family tragedies. I want that drama in there, as many of us, you know, suffered through, you know, our lives from not being able to drink in a bar. Mm-hmm. There were great athletes in Warroad that played with the Warroad Muskies, at the Accabees, that played on the Warroad town teams, that wonderful baseball players. Everybody else would go to the bars, and they wouldn't be able to, because they were blackballed. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that. There's from various tribes throughout the United States and from various sports. So you're going to have those type of stories where you may have been racially profiled, you know, had that prejudice, had that denigration that one goes through. And, you know, we have to dig. We have to dig. We have to research. We have to do a story in each and every one of these and put a script together and start filming. But the interviews are going to be... Yeah, because we go back to 1904 when one of our subjects ran in the marathon in St. Louis. It was, I think it was 90-some degrees out, and they started running inside of the stadium for the first round or two, and then they ran on a dirt road. And their first, I think their first water stop was 18 miles. And most of them didn't make it, mm-hmm. You know. So you want to talk about, you know, where he came from, what kind of family he had, talk about that race and how crazy that was over, you know, in high humidity and not having a drink of water for 18 miles or something, 12 miles. Or, I can't remember what it was right offhand, but it was a long ways.
I know that once you're continue this journey, you have your book and you're going to be doing the film production. Those resources, I think, are necessary for schools, our school children, to get access to these resources. And there's got to be a way to get your book, especially your book, right now, into our public and private schools.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. The United States government's done a tremendous job of keeping quiet. The colonization of the United States, you know, a fight against the Redskins and how that all developed and how the colonization put out $200 rewards for a dead Indian and mm-hmm. how they were scalped and the blood ran down their face. And, mm-hmm. you know, just because the Redskins have been in existence, the white people who care about that, or anybody that cares about the Redskins, and they say it's not denigrating, it's, we're proud of the name and all this and that. That's, that's got to stop, and that's the reason. It's those are things that, we have to stand up for. We have to stop some of the prejudice and the racism by taking away these horrible names and what they signify for the Indian people and all others.
I think we all should work toward that because that is the denigration of a group of people, that this is your country. This is your land. And,
well, we are the keepers of Mother Earth, and we
absolutely,
you know, we keep up the fight. We certainly haven't won any battles yet, but we haven't lost a war yet either.
That's right. So I do a lot of shows, episodes, if you will, regarding the Native heritage community in the Twin Ports. And if you would take some time, Mr. Boucher, to offer some words of wisdom for young people of color, Native heritage, young people especially, in particular, the importance of staying in school, the importance of being successful, and the importance of staying connected to the earth. If you could offer some words of wisdom, because I think, especially for our young people, but for all people listening to the show, it's important to hear from you and to get as much of your wisdom as we possibly can into the hearts and minds of people who need it and want it.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It's, you know, education is, it's so important. When you look back on the education of the storytelling of the Indian people and how the government basically kept all of that stuff out of the books, you'll see now that there's more filmmakers, there's more writers that are telling the true stories of the American Indian plight, of our assimilation. We need to come out, we need to go to school, we need to finish school, we need to go to college, and we need to beat the general public on education. I really think that we need more people like Shalice that were going into law. We have a lot of lawyers out there now. We need more. We need our young people to stand up. We need our elders to lead us and give us that wisdom. We need, I'm 65. I'll be 66 this year, and I'm tired, especially today with my cold. But I am so proud of Shalice and the young people, and you have to encourage each other, and you have to motivate each other to say, hey, we've got to take on these issues. If we don't do it, who's going to?
Mm-hmm. Well, Shalice will be an attorney. I can just look at her now from this distance and guaranteed that she's going to be an attorney. And so I know that as a person of color myself, I know that we're in good hands. And we're going to be in good hands moving forward with people like you, Shalice.
I mean, Gwetch, for that. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. It's. I'm not just saying that. I truly believe that. Your grandfather, again, is a legend and has done so much, not only for his grandkids, people that are next to you, your aunts, your sisters, your brothers, your nephews, your nieces. But having a person like this in your life, and you talked about earlier, Shalice, about how he was a jokester, is a jokester, and how he keeps you on the straight and narrow, if you will, and gives you that wisdom and advice for your future. For young people listening, young people of color especially listening to the show today, what would you say to them, Shalice, for their future, encouraging them to be the best they can be?
Well, I guess my first thing would just be to, like my grandpa said, to education is key. And, that was one of the ways the government tried to assimilate us, was through boarding schools. And today, looking back on that history, we can take that, what they tried to use against us, and turn it around and become more educated and fight wars with education. That would be my first point. And then the second point would be to go to our elders like this, because those traditional ones, we need to go to them and talk to them about their experience and language and everything, and that's just going to bring us full circle.
Absolutely. I want to take this time to thank Henry Boucher, NHL hockey legend, Shalice Snowden, UWS student, for taking the time to be on People of Color with Henry Banks today. Any final words, Mr. Boucher, that you would like to share with our listeners?
Well, I'd love it if everybody bought a book out there, of course, but certainly, you know, go to henryboucher.com. You can certainly buy it on Amazon, but look forward to the reading of the book. I think you'll get a lot out of it. And then just remember to stay close to family, respect the elders, visit your family more often, get your education. And that's the only way we're going to win the war is by, like Shalice said, is motivating our younger kids to do the right thing. And we need to do a better job taking care of our environment. And you do that starting locally, and just get on board and do something and don't just say it.
Thank you very much. I am so honored to have had the opportunity to have Mr. Boucher here. Also, Shalice, thank you for taking the time to come and join us and have this wonderful conversation. This is People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Henry Banks. I'm here with Mary Villiard. She is the Arts and Culture Program Coordinator at the American Indian Community Housing Organization in Duluth, and she has some exciting information, some updates about the happenings at the ACO organization. And Mary, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, it's been a while since you've been here. And we like to update the community on things going on in our communities of color and our indigenous communities. And the American Indian Housing Organization had an exciting event some weeks ago now. Why don't you tell our listeners about that?
All right. So a couple of weeks ago, we announced the new title for Trepanier Hall, which is our main kind of arts and community and culture space in our American Indian Center on 2nd and 2nd Street. Originally, our building was a YWCA, and we had this auditorium space where we've been hosting all of our events. We just recently, our board came together and decided to rename it after Dr. Robert Paulus. So it is now the Dr. Robert Paulus Cultural Center. We felt like that title was more fitting to all of the things that were happening in Trepanier Hall, and it also sort of reflected just all of the good in that's happening in our community. And we also wanted to recognize Dr. Robert Paulus, who was, I would say, influential early on in the development of the Gamaji building, where that entire space is enclosed.
You know, Dr. Paulus, I've known him for years. And so, as you said earlier, this was so fitting. And I think your board did a great thing by renaming this the center in his honor.
Right.
So what was it like when you found out that the board had decided to do this?
I feel like it was maybe about a month before when it was officially decided that they were going to name it after Dr. Robert Paulus. They hadn't come up with the full title yet, and it was kind of like a slight buzz that was sort of going around between staff and everybody, like, we're going to change the name, we're going to honor Dr. Paulus, but we're not sure what the name is going to be and how to incorporate, like, all the things that we do, and also not have it be incredibly lengthy, because a lot happens there. And so that notice sort of went out, and we decided to keep it under wraps from Dr. Paulus. Well, basically, he comes on a pretty much a weekly basis with his wife to visit Gamaji, and he'll sit in our lobby and he'll interact with the kids, interact with the staff, interact with everybody, and make it kind of a really welcoming space. And so it was hard for a lot of us to kind of not make any mention of it, not make any public announcements or formal announcements. And when he actually got there, we did the announcement in our gymnasium in the lower level, so we directed all of those hundreds of people down the stairs, mm-hmm. and I'm sure people were confused because they're used to going into Trepanier Hall. But we directed everyone downstairs and made that announcement, and it was a surprise for him, and it was a wonderful thing.
Yeah, he was really touched by this.
Yeah.
The fact that you were able to keep it from him,
right?
That's pretty impressive, because he knows a lot about that organization,
right.
there, and so that was very cool that you were able to pull that off.
Yeah, we weren't sure, but yeah,
but you did it.
Yeah.
So there are so many exciting things going on at ACO. Would you share with our listeners some of those things that are coming up,
yeah.
and in the Dr. Robert Paulus Cultural Center?
Yeah, there's always things happening pretty much every week at ACO. Tomorrow we have our full moon ceremony at 6:30, which is a ceremony for Indigenous women that's open for women to attend. Our current exhibit up in the Dr. Robert Paulus Cultural Center is a photo exhibit by Jennifer Houck and Madison Johnson, and they did some really interesting small-scale photos. They're just really nostalgic sort of images. They're really pleasant to look at, but they also incorporated, like, embroidery thread into some of the images. The thread totally adds just this whole other texture to their imagery, and it gives it a really good feel. It's a great exhibit. And towards the end of the month, we're hoping to have another exhibit with Leah Yellowbird with her new body of work, which is also just incredibly tactile and interesting. And she's been doing incredible stuff with layers and layers of resin and paint and doing furniture and beadwork and painting together. She's really, really kind of expanded her body of work. Another announcement I can kind of make, it's still in the works, but we're going to be transforming our other space, our main white gallery space, into an area where art will be more accessible to purchase on a regular basis and more fully staffed there. So I won't give you all the details.
But on the move, though, ACO continues to be on the move.
Yep.
Inspiring, changing lives. I want to ask you, what are some of the things you do as a coordinator of arts and culture for ACO with children?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting part of my job is just getting to work a lot. We do have a full-time children's program coordinator now, which is really cool because she has a weekly schedule that she does with the children that are involved in our programs. But I get to partner with her a lot to do really exciting arts-related things with the kids, and it always just brings me tons and tons of joy. I mean, recently our kids got to go to the Homeless Day on the Hill at the Capitol, the state capitol, a few weeks back.
And that's the capital of Minnesota, right?
Yep.
Okay.
In St. Paul. It was really cool because people were walking by on the street and they recognized the kids because their work has been on display in the cities now from the In Progress exhibit that we did a few months or back in August when I first started working with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so that show has been circulating kind of across Minnesota now as a representation of like these really unique perspectives of urban Indigenous youth,
mm-hmm.
who have stories and perspectives that aren't necessarily represented. A lot of people in the mainstream kind of think of them in very sort of isolated terms, I guess, and they don't picture them having lives in cities or in lives outside of reservations. And so it was really, that whole project in and of itself was a really enlightening experience for a lot of people. So it went on display at the Department of Human Services. I think Minnesota Housing, they have headquarters in the cities. It's been getting around. And a few weeks after that, we brought another group of those kids down to the Department of Human Services for a closing reception where they got to sign their artwork and give their autograph to the staff. They were incredibly welcoming. And I don't know, there's always exciting things.
You enjoy your job, don't you?
I love it.
I can tell you enjoy your job just by the happiness and the look on your face,
yeah.
and the joy that this brings you. That in and of itself is important because when you enjoy your job, you're not only just getting more out of it, you're impacting people in such a way that it's an infectious thing.
Right.
You know, and it comes out like that with you.
It's definitely a fun work environment too. We're all like all the staff, no matter what their specific area of expertise is, we always tend to come together for events and things like that and really just enjoy each other's presence and enjoy the rush of bringing our community together for good things.
Absolutely. Is there anything else you would like to leave with our listeners?
If you haven't already, stop into ACO and see what we're about. Ask for a tour. Stop in, look at our art galleries, visit our new spaces, and there's always changes happening.
Yeah, ACO is located in the old or former YWCA building in downtown Duluth. Mary Villiard, thank you again for being here on People of Color. Mary is the Arts and Culture Program Coordinator at the American Indian Community Housing Organization in Duluth, Minnesota. Have a great evening and a great weekend. Have you heard the news? Have you heard of the Family Freedom Center? Yes, that's the Family Freedom Center. To engage, Family Freedom Center fosters positive change in systemic landscapes that directly impact our communities. To empower, Family Freedom Center empowers the Black community while being inclusive to all. To educate, Family Freedom Center teams up with community members to assist in a 12-week curriculum during the spring. For more information, contact Family Freedom Center at 218-625-1665, extension 234. Family Freedom Center is located at 2424 West 5th Street, Suite 102 in Duluth, Minnesota. That's every Friday from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. and Saturdays 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Family Freedom Center. Hold your head up.